Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with biographer Christoph Irmscher about the great American scientist Louis Agassiz.
He revolutionized the way science was taught. He would show up in the classroom with specimens in his pockets.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Timothy Naftali, former director of the Nixon Presidential Library, celebrates, or at least observes, this president's 100th anniversary.
And the question you, as an American, you have to ask yourself, to what extent does it matter that we were led by a president with such a dark psyche?
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. One of the most important figures in the history of American science, and one of the most controversial, was the great figure Louis Agassiz, who's the subject of a new biography. It's called Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. It's by Christoph Irmscher. It's reviewed for us by Rebecca Stott, who says it's an evocative new biography, and Irmscher is a richly descriptive writer with an eye for detail, the complexities and contradictions of his character. I'm delighted that Christoph joins us from Bloomington. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we do have a very complex, contradictory figure. Tell us a little bit about him. When and where was he born? What were his great years? And what's he best remembered for today?
He was born in Switzerland. He was Swiss originally. He was born in 1807 in Moutier, which is essentially sort of small kind of village close to the mountains. And most of all his training was, in fact, in Europe. He went to the great universities, Heidelberg, Munich. That's where he got his degree from the University of Munich, and started teaching at a small college in Neuchâtel, Switzerland, where he built a reputation as a collector of natural specimens, as a very, very prolific writer, as somebody who was basically unstoppable. And thanks to the patronage of Alexander von Humboldt, really the greatest, best-known sort of scientific entrepreneur, traveler, and lecturer of his time, he came to the United States and was just supposed to be a short stay, but he was offered a position at Harvard University and stayed.
And Christoph, at his height, how renowned a figure was he? Was he America's best-known scientist in this period?
I think that's fair to say, that he was the best-known and most encyclopedically interested scientist of his time. Everybody respected him. Darwin, who became his great antagonist, would turn to him for specimens, for advice, for information. He was the data man, so to speak, somebody who knew facts and was willing to provide them. He built quite an image as a not just as a collector, but as a man who was undaunted. When he was still in Switzerland, he would climb mountains. He would be found high up on the glaciers. He would have himself lowered into crevasses of glaciers. So he was a man whose physical courage was notorious, even, and people admired him for that.
Was he a great teacher and important author as well?
He was a great teacher, and that is probably his most lasting contribution to the history of science. He revolutionized the way science was taught. He would show up in the classroom with specimens in his pockets and would pull them out. And he was famous for the boast that given a single scale of a fish, of a fossil fish, he could reconstruct the entire fish. And he would do that on the blackboard. And he was ambidextrous, which was part of his appeal. You know, he would use both hands and draw with both hands while he was talking. And people just admired that. By the same token, he would also take people outside. His students would have to be in the field and do field work. On the beach, he was so obsessive that when he couldn't get specimens out of the water, his jellyfish, for instance, which would die, you know, in short order when he cut them out, he would go in the water himself physically, microscope in hand, and plunge the water just into the water so that he could see what he wanted to see.
Christoph, what some of our listeners may identify Agassiz with, what he's most famous for today probably, is something quite controversial and provocative, and that is his disagreement with the era's greatest scientist of all, Charles Darwin. What was the origin of that, as it were, and what was that debate about?
It was essentially the question whether things in nature move or don't. And for Darwin would see development around him, he would look at chance mutations that would then, you know, initiate changes and so forth. And for Agassiz, nature, nothing in nature traveled. Things stayed where they'd been created. It's not quite accurate to say that in some ways, because there was some movement built into nature, but there was a divine purpose behind it. So the world as it surrounds us, everything's been created by God, and there was a divine plan behind everything that we see. And that divine plan to Agassiz was knowable for the scientist. The scientist was essentially like a god in the making. Just give him enough time and money, which was important for Agassiz, and you can figure it out. So the divinity that resides in nature is something that potentially resides in us too, which is why the transcendentalists loved him and just felt he was sort of a blood brother to them in a way. And of course, for Darwin, that was not a hypothesis, not an explanation that he needed in order to understand nature. There was no divine purpose behind the things that he could see. There's this famous letter to Asa Gray in which he essentially says, let each man believe what he can, that for him, nature's plan was not something that could be deciphered. Agassiz was traditional in the sense that he believed in the book of nature, and that nature was fully readable, fully legible to him. The record was not broken. Darwin would say again and again that the geological record that we have is imperfect, which is why these transitional specimens that people always wanted to see could not be produced. For Agassiz, the record was only imperfect because we hadn't completely understood it, and it needed more effort. And that's the ideological controversy between the two, Agassiz being the conservative one, and in that aspect of his work, and Darwin, of course, being the innovative, progressive thinker.
And in retrospect, or with the passage of time, has Agassiz's reputation suffered for that conflict, that disagreement?
Absolutely, absolutely. It suffered in his own time because of the attacks that he was exposed to at Harvard. Asa Gray, Darwin's great friend, who was also on the faculty, made it his project to torment Agassiz, as he called it. And letters would report, you know, on how he would destroy him. And Agassiz, when he died in 1873, most of his students, most of his former associates, had in fact, for better or worse, accepted Darwinism as a working hypothesis in their work. And he became a footnote in the history of science as far as his theories are concerned. So in a sense, you know, people would ridicule him afterwards, and he got a reputation of somewhat of a scientific windbag, somebody who, you know, made much ado about nothing. By the same token, when you talk to scientists, practicing scientists, people who do field work and so forth, Agassiz is still somebody who set a model of observation, of close observation, of careful description, of, as I said, being in the field and exposing oneself to nature. He would describe it to his students as catching nature in the act, which meant being outside, waiting, being very, very patient. And he was really obsessive about how you would need to prepare yourself for that type of field work. In one of his books, he talks about microscopic work, and he said you shouldn't eat before you look through the microscope, you know, to kind of purify yourself. So you would just be an eye, you know, peering through the microscope. There's a story that he liked to tell that when he had trouble seeing at one period in his life, he had trouble with his eyes, he would pick up a specimen, use his tongue, and would actually taste it. He would lick it to get close to it.
Thanks so much, Christoph.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Christoph Irmscher, whose book, Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
So kids' books, they're bigger than ever, and now they're sort of taking over the entire universe. What's going on?
Everyone does love young readers. Well, so there was a lot. This week we had the awards out of Seattle, the American Library Association Awards, which people always care very much about, the Newbery Award, which went to a very charming book called The One and Only Ivan. And that is by a woman, Catherine Applegate, who is a very prolific children's writer. With her husband, she wrote something called Animorphs, which sold 35 million copies worldwide.
Wow.
But The One and Only Ivan is a story about a gorilla. It is, in her own words, a first-person gorilla, and it won the award.
Now, there's also the Caldecott. Now, Newbery is for writing. Is that right, for the text?
And well, there's also an illustration award. In fact, the guy who won – well, they have illustration. I think – I'm trying to think. They also have other categories like having to do with gay and lesbian literature, having to do with African-American literature. But illustrators can win as well. But what was very interesting this year for the Newbery Prize, an illustrator-turned-writer-illustrator not only was a finalist for the awards, but also won the award. This Is Not My Hat by a man named John Clausen.
Now, what about the Caldecotts? What are the that's just a completely separate group of awards?
Or? Oh, no, it's the Caldecott Newbery. They're just for different – so he won – I'm sorry, for the Caldecott. He won for the Caldecott, and she won for the Newbery.
Speaking of children's books, authors, just the peerless Dr. Seuss. And I will lead this off by saying the Dr. Seuss book that my pretentious family embraced – was not The Cat in the Hat and all of that. It was The 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, which is actually an extraordinary thing. He drew the worst horses ever. But it's the language is written in this almost kind of Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's court.
It's in
sort
prose,
of elevated
right?
prose. It's really fine. But there's an aspect to that we didn't know about Dr. Seuss and his hats.
Right. So here's the hidden story behind Bartholomew Cubbins, and that's actually what we're celebrating now, the anniversary of that book. Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, was a hat collector, a wacky hat collector. And it makes me happy to think that Dr. Seuss was a wacky hat collector. And so a lot of the inspirations you see in his book, Crazy Feathered Hats, actually came from his collection instead of the other way around. He was inspired by hats. He apparently used to hold formal dinner parties and make his guests wear wacky, wacky headdresses. We have for the New York Times pictures of him in wacky, wacky headdresses.
Now, where are all these hats? Did he keep – he lived in California, didn't he?
Yes,
did
he lived in Southern California. He did, but in fact, for the anniversary of Bartholomew Cubbins.
So what anniversary is that, Leslie?
It's the 75th anniversary.
Wow, a true classic.
Right, a true classic. To honor that, Random House has teamed up with the New York City Public Library to show all of Dr. Seuss's hat. His hat collection will now, for the first time, be traveling around the country. It will open here next week.
So you've seen some of them. Are they really crazy?
Where'd he get them? Some of them are great. He collected them from all over the world. In the end, people sent them. You can see the Cat in the Hat hat, which is...
Oh, that's that big top hat.
The very big, tall top hat. We have pictures of him in what look like blue and purple feathers. But we've seen him in helmets with spikes.
Oh, so those are pictured, or at least versions of them, in the great story.
Absolutely. And what's so amusing to me as I go through it, I now realize how important hats are in Dr. Seuss's work, which I hadn't noticed before. But in retrospect, now you can see it.
And did he really have 500?
I think he had more closer to 333 or something like that, but he had quite a lot.
That's a lot. Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Well, we just passed the 100th birthday, the centennial of my favorite American president. Favorite because after Abraham Lincoln, he's the most interesting. Richard Nixon, and no one knows more about him than Timothy Naftali, a historian, distinguished historian and author, who was also for 5 years the director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library. So special treat. He's here to talk about it. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be here.
All right. Now, Nixon's so complex, so interesting. Let's just do a kind of overview of him. I have said to people that there's more good writing about Nixon than maybe any president but Lincoln. The great book by Gary Wills. He's always interesting when Theodore White writes about him. What is it? Thomas Malin wrote a wonderful novel about Watergate. Why does Nixon continue to fascinate us?
Well, first of all, he's the first and so far only president to resign. Secondly, he was a controversial figure even before he became president. There are many people who identify him with the red baiting of the 1950s. He was on the American stage for 50 years. He elicited very strong reactions from people. They either liked him, loved him, or hated him. People weren't left cold about him. They had a if they had an opinion about Nixon, it was a strong one. He managed to provoke that from people, and I think that's sort of what you need. If you want to become an iconic figure, you've got to be able to stir passions. In Nixon's case, both positive and negative.
He was essentially an introvert, which is so rare for a great political figure. He was not a glad-hander like Bill Clinton. He didn't have the outward charismatic charm of an Obama or a Reagan. What's your sense of what Nixon was really like as a person?
Richard Nixon was an extremely secretive man. One of the things that people who study the Nixon tapes see very or hear very quickly.
So these are the famous tapes
in
the White House.
There are roughly 4,000 hours, not all of conversation. Some of them are just of room noise. But you have at least 2,500 to 3,000 hours of conversation involving Richard Nixon, because the system only was turned on when Nixon was in the room. Anyway, those tapes show you, demonstrate that is, that he spoke differently to different people. There were circles of trust, if you will, for him. My sense, after having listened to a lot of these tapes, because I worked on tapes when I was at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia before I joined the U.S. government. If you really want to know what Nixon thought about something controversial, you have to sit with him when he's talking to Charles Colson, his advisor, and his chief of staff, H.R. Bob Haldeman. As you got further away from the center, the cockpit of the presidency for Nixon, the Nixon changes. On the outer edges, the Nixon that appeared was much more balanced, much more philosophical. His tone of his voice is different. That's the Nixon that many people saw. But the inner Nixon, spikes of that would come out. It was like lava coming up through the ground. And so people saw hints of that, but they were never sure whether that was the core of the Nixonian earth or not, which that's what makes him so remarkable, because he was layered. He was self-disciplined. The fact that he was an introvert is important because he was very self-conscious. And so he was, to a large extent, able to control which Nixon his interlocutor met. And that's what's made him so complicated for historians and biographers. That's what's made him a source of controversy and debate, because it depends which Nixon you're talking about and which is the true Nixon. My sense, having listened to many of the Nixons, perhaps too many, is that the real inner Nixon is the Nixon with Colson and Haldeman. And that's a very dark and edgy, but not in a positive way, Nixon.
You know, it's interesting, Tim, something Theodore White points out in his book, The Making of the President, 1972, is that Nixon had, and you hinted at this, a more expansive, successful record on presidential tickets, either as a president or vice president, than any figure since Franklin Roosevelt. He was twice elected vice president, twice elected president, lost for president once, barely to the most charismatic figure in modern American politics, John F. Kennedy. So the question is, what was the voting public seeing in him? Themselves in some way?
Well, after all, some of the most interesting work about Nixon is not about Nixon, it's about us. Nixon is the prism through which American life is refracted, right? Richard Nixon understood, though he was not a glad-hander by any stretch of the imagination, he understood American politics very well. That's one. Secondly, he was extraordinarily bright, maybe even brilliant. I mean, this is a very—
Does this come through in the tapes at all, by the way, the intellectual gifts?
You know what it comes through? The library found some briefings that he gave to larger groups, and we released, when I was there, I tried hard to release some of them. That's when we would give what's always been described as the tour d'horizon, Nixon's tour d'horizon. In later life, as a post-president, he would give these on occasion. They are fascinating, and by the way, they are really, really smart. He understood why he was opening the door to China. I mean, he actually had a strategic mind. It is rare in an American politician, I think in a politician of any country, but I happen to know this one reasonably well. It's hard to find a strategist as opposed to a tactician.
It's so funny you say that, because somebody else I interviewed told me exactly the same thing about Nixon. No surprise, but still interesting. Henry Kissinger said it was the one president who actually had a strategic mind about global affairs.
And Henry should know, or Dr. Kissinger should know. You know, one of the things that I'm convinced of is that the China idea, which really was a good one for the country, for the world, it was Nixon's idea. I'm absolutely convinced of it. My sense is that Kissinger was very reluctant in the beginning and had to be convinced that this was a smart idea. Anyhow, so Richard Nixon in a large group could be masterful. And by the way, the library has countless numbers of yellow legal pads full of his outlines and notes. He was so self-controlled that he would outline a talk over and over again and work it before going out there. And he wouldn't read from notes. It would be done in a way that seemed extemporaneous.
Right. He was very proud of that.
But it wasn't. It was completely planned. And I think that lent to his character a fragility. Somebody who is so controlled is always on the verge of some kind of spasm, if you will, of a personality spasm. He was so controlled. What Richard Nixon has done by leaving us this incredible audio collection is that whether he liked it or not, and in the end he didn't, he has led us into his psyche. And when we move into the psyche, it's a dark space. And the question you, as an American, you have to ask yourself, to what extent does it matter that we were led by a president with such a dark psyche? And that's, I think, what makes the debate really interesting, because those tapes are not going away. When I was there, we were able to release the next large tranche, a few tranches actually, and there's one more big tranche to come out. And then you'll have them, and they're inescapable. And their message is not ambiguous. The dark psyche is consistent throughout the tapes. It's not just one conversation. It's not two.
Give us an example of the darkness you're talking about.
Well, I'll tell you about a conversation that made me sick. Now, some of this I'd known about before I took the job, because at the Miller Center, I mean, we'd heard the tape where Richard Nixon says that all American Jews are disloyal, and where he tells Haldeman to get Fred Malik to make a list of every Jew in the U.S. government so that a Gentile can be put over top of them because they're disloyal. I'd heard that before. What was striking was just how general a pattern this was. This wasn't just some moment of craziness. Where I saw the cynicism and the immorality was when I heard a conversation involving Haldeman and Richard Nixon in December of 1972. It's a conversation we released. It's available. It's declassified. It's a conversation about the Holocaust. There had just been a service at the chapel near the White House, and the president had asked, I believe it was John Cardinal Kroll of Philadelphia, they have visiting pastors or visiting priests, and he gave the benediction. And at the same time, they had invited a choir of young German boys to sing some hymns. And John Cardinal Kroll had himself just been to Warsaw, and he talked about the Holocaust in very moving terms, apparently. And Nixon was furious. He said, why would you have this man say this in front of those German boys? Leave him alone. Don't, let's not just continue this. And then this led Haldeman and Nixon, first of all, to talk about how to censor the benedictions at the church, but also, and this is just unbelievable, they talked about their visit to the Warsaw Ghetto. And they said, oh, God, those Jews, they do it over and over again. It's just too much. Yeah, some people died at Auschwitz, but, you know, they've exaggerated the numbers, and they just, and, you know, Israel does it for sympathy, and, oh, it's terrible, oh, and then they just, and then the two of them, you know, they come from sort of a tradition of the Southern California anti-Semitism, and they just riffed off of each other, and the meanness, and the fact that they couldn't show any sympathy about the Holocaust. I'm not suggesting, you know, that any kind of anti-Semitism is acceptable, but I could see in their discussion, this frat boy locker room discussion about the Holocaust, that there was no moral center to these men. You can't possibly speak this way about mass murder and have a moral center. I'm sorry, I'm a little passionate.
No, that
about
is extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. And I was so taken aback. I made a transcript and I sent it to the Archivist of the United States. And I said, you know, this is just horrible. And what was very important for me as the director of the library was never to be in a position to say anything about Nixon that the National Archives or I would regret. So I praised his policies when it was natural and you know, understandable to do. But I never engaged, and I hope the National Archives never engages in the, well, on the one hand, on the other hand. Because we shouldn't be sending an example to kids that you can do bad things and think bad thoughts, but if you also do a few good things, all will be forgiven, particularly if you're president, because a president has enormous amounts of power. We sort of homogenize and sanitize our presidents a little bit. We want them to be okay. Not that each one will be on Mount Rushmore. That's for a very select few. But we want your middling president to be okay. And I was really interested, and I'm still interested in seeing in this 100th anniversary year, the extent to which people will say, yes, there was Watergate. But on the other hand, because I think that if you do that, you invite presidential amnesia. And if you do that, you lose the power of having history act as a check on presidents. Because, you know, presidents care about their legacies. And if they know that all will be forgiven, I'm afraid that it gives them a little bit too much latitude, Republican or Democratic presidents. So when I heard this, I'm sharing it because it was the worst conversation I heard. And there were several very bad ones in the last release. There are some Kissinger and Nixon talking about the Jews in the USSR, but also, you know, the conversation's not theirs, but Nixon's about African Americans, and you know, he orders the army to go and attack the Indians and Native Americans at Wounded Knee. Fortunately, that order was not followed through, but that would have been a massacre. There are really bad things on the tapes. I believe, therefore, that you have to be very careful with Nixon, not to put yourself in a position where you turn a blind side to abuses of power. Because if you do, I think you're laying the ground for future abuses of power. So Nixon is not only important as this cultural figure who elicits some laughter as well as concern and respect, but he's also a test of how our country deals with presidents who do the wrong thing.
Thanks so much, Tim.
My pleasure.
That was Timothy Naftali, former director of the Nixon Presidential Library and historian and author. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the lists this week?
Well, the only three new titles on the fiction side of things are all from familiar names. At number five, Kim Harrison, the supernatural romance writer, has a new book out called Ever After. That's new on the hardcover fiction list at number five. At number three, Robert Crace is new on the list with his latest book, Suspect. And at number one, our old friend James Patterson has the latest book in his private series. It's called Private Berlin. He wrote it with Mark Sullivan. That is new at number one.
I want to see this man's tax return. What about nonfiction?
There's just one new book on the nonfiction side of things this week. Just in time for pitchers and catchers to report to camp in a few weeks, we've got Terry Francona, the former Boston Red Sox manager and current Cleveland Indians manager, with kind of a tell-all, barn-burning book called Francona. He wrote it with a columnist for the Boston Globe, Dan Shaughnessy. The subtitle is The Red Sox Years, and it's looking back. Francona, of course, was extremely successful with the Boston Red Sox. He came in.
They won a World Series with him.
For the first time since 1918. Everyone thought they would never win another World Series again. They brought him in 2004, and with a team that he inherited, a team that Theo Epstein had put together, he brought them to the World Series that first year in 2004, and they won. And then they won again in 2007 under him. So he was extremely successful. They didn't do as well after that. And by the end of the 2011 season, the owners were fed up with him. They kind of collapsed toward the end of that season, and the owners chose not to renew his contract when it expired.
Now, this book is number two on the nonfiction list. Is that right?
It is.
It's quite high up. What's the interest? There must be some kind of gossipy news in here.
Yeah. What's interesting, because, of course, it's got interest in Boston and some in New York, because the Red Sox are such rivals with the Yankees. And there are a lot of Red Sox fans here in New York, too. But it's getting national interest. Partly, Francona has become a national figure because of his success with the Red Sox and because he's out in Cleveland now. And his father played for the Indians. He's got kind of Midwest roots. But it's also because he really doesn't hold back in this book. He attacks the owners. And the Boston Globe printed three different excerpts from the book where he went after the owners hard for their lack of knowledge or love of baseball and said they were just all about the money. One of the excerpts talked about a marketing team that they had brought in who said, we need to make the team sexier. We need to bring in good-looking stars. You know, the game's not exciting enough. It all needs to be about marketability.
And they were probably in, like, first place at the time or something.
Yeah, exactly right. At the start of the 2011 season, they started strong, then they collapsed, then they came back, then they collapsed again. And so this was just after the first collapse.
Now, here's a question you can answer for me, maybe. Is Terry Francona the same as Tito Francona, or is that the father?
Well, the father went by Tito. Terry also goes by Tito. It's a nickname.
I'll tell you why. In 1962, I think it was, my older brother went to a Yankees game. He was a huge Yankees fan. And at that age, he would have been about 11. He went with my uncle, who visited from Binghamton. I wasn't invited along. I was too young. So my uncle snatched a foul ball that was hit into the stands, the only one my family has.
Yeah.
And it was hit by Tito Francona in 1962.
So that would have been the father.
That would have been the father.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anything else of interest on the nonfiction list?
To define of interest, Bill O'Reilly is still on the list with his book Killing Lincoln. It's been on the list now for 70 weeks, longer than anything except for Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken and Killing Kennedy, which has now been on the list for 17 weeks. And it's kind of ushered in this interest in books about assassination. If you go back to the hardcover fiction list now, last week, there were three of the four new books to hit the list last week, all had to do with presidential assassinations. There's Brad Meltzer's The Fifth Assassin, Stephen Hunter's The Third Bullet, which is going back looking at a Kennedy conspiracy, and this book about Abraham Lincoln, Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker by Jennifer Chiaverini, which isn't about the assassination per se, but of course, as you'd expect in a book set in that time, the assassination plays a climactic role in the book. It's interesting these books are all hitting the list now. I looked at it a little bit trying to gauge whether it reflected some kind of dark mood in the American political landscape. All the kind of Dinesh D'Souza anti-Obama books have dropped off of the list after the election, but suddenly there's this surge in assassination books. But I think really the answer is we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, so it's on everybody's mind because of that. And because Bill O'Reilly's been having this huge success with the Lincoln book and the Kennedy book, I think people want in on that. Brad Meltzer told PBS NewsHour recently that he actually got the idea for his book. He often writes political thrillers, so this isn't out of the ordinary for what you'd expect from him. The Department of Homeland Security called him a few years ago to invite him in for a program they were doing where they were trying to envision what terrorists might do in America, how they might attack America. And they paired him with a secret security agent, and they tossed around ideas, and that got him interested. I said secret security, secret service agent. That got him interested in the Secret Service and thinking about political assassinations. And he did this whole book with a national archivist as the hero.
Well, for someone like me, old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination, I was very young. I was in grade school, but I remember it vividly. That's still the great trauma, the great public trauma. And with all due respect and honor, a more greater drama than September 11th, 2001.
And obviously, it's sold a lot of books even before this 50th anniversary year.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.